everybody, and welcome back to the Saltworks podcast. We're so excited you're here with us today, whether you're listening or watching. We're just honored to have you here. I can't wait to introduce to you a guest today that has been a long time coming, and I'm excited to share her story with you today. So welcome to the podcast, Felicia Toler.
Thank you, Hallie.
It's so exciting to me. Most of the time, I have known the guest, you know, because you listen, how it normally goes. But you and I actually met through the podcast, which is a first for me. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just really excited. This is exciting to me in a lot of ways.
Me too. And I feel honored to be a part of this because I've listened to your podcast and I really enjoy it. And it's something that, you know, is part of my life.
Oh, thank you so much. That means more to us than you know. And we will get more into that story and how we kind of got to know each other. But you know, because you listen, that we always start out with, who is Felicia Toler?
Well, I can first and foremost say I'm a miracle. Mm-hmm. And once you hear my story, you'll know why.
Yeah.
And I'm a wife to Tim. Mm-hmm. We've been married almost 29 years in June. I am a mother to Allie and Anna Kate, a mother-in-law to Stephen, and the best title I've ever had is Sassy to Mary Catherine.
I love it. Sassy. I didn't know that was your grandmother.
That's
name.
My name.
We're trying to convince our kids to, well, one of my nephews couldn't say Hallie. And so he called me Happy for a while. Aww. And I was like, that is so kind, undeserved title, but so kind. And so we've told our kids that we want to be happy and grumpy. They haven't quite like taken to it, but you know, we're like, if we just keep drilling them with it over the years, maybe it'll stick.
Well, I kept telling, I wanted my husband to be called Grumps because he's grumpy. And he said, no way. So he's Papa.
I love that. Well, yeah, if you know me and Andrew, those are like backwards. Like I should probably be grumpy and he should probably be happy, but you know,
it is what it is.
That's right. That's right. Our motto around here. Well, tell us just a little bit, because your story really starts, the story we're sharing today really starts mostly in high school.
Right.
But would you just tell us like basic childhood, you know, what did you believe by yourself? Where did you grow up?
Right.
What did that look like?
Well, when I was very young, my parents weren't in church, and I went to church with my grandmother, and that's why, you know, that's when I heard about Jesus. And but when we moved to Arkansas, my mom joined a church and got saved, and we went. My dad did not. I'm an only child.
Yeah.
I had wonderful parents, but they weren't real good together. They kind of were like oil and water. And, you know, so that was not always easy.
Yeah.
Both my parents loved me very much. Mm-hmm. And my mom had me at church every time the doors opened.
Yeah.
And I was in a Southern Baptist church. And so I knew about Jesus. But I didn't know about a relationship. You know, I got saved at Bible school like at 8, but I didn't have the fruits of that. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't have that relationship with Jesus that, you know, I should have.
Yeah. Would you say you were someone who, because of that and because, you know, like when you are lacking that surrender of like, it's him, it's not me, did you struggle with like perfectionism, like trying, you know, doing things on your own?
I was a big time perfectionist, and I think a lot of that was the only child thing too. You know, I wanted to be the best and to make my parents proud, and you know, all of those things. And you know, that was my focus more than what it should have been.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's such, I feel like it's a very easy pitfall for women. But yeah, I mean, as an only child, even when your parents don't expect that, you know, sometimes we can just like place expectations on ourselves at a young age.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, it was more myself than anything.
Yeah, I can relate to that. Well, getting into high school, and I can see even where like you're wanting to please, maybe that would be a way would lead straight into this season.
Definitely. I was always, I wanted the approval of others. You know, that was a big deal to me. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why. I mean, that was just part of my personality. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just, I wanted to be popular. I wanted to fit in. I wanted everybody to like me.
Yeah.
And, you know, that led me down some dark roads, you know, because of that.
Right. Can you tell us about what that looked like and how that played out in your high school?
Well, you know, we're a little small town, you know, nothing to do. Yeah. And so a lot of times the kids drank and, you know, premarital sex. And, and I fell into that trap. You know, I wanted to fit in, and I met, you know, I had a boyfriend, and, you know, I just, I wanted him to accept me. And so I did things that I shouldn't have done because I wanted that.
Yeah.
And we had a very toxic relationship. But, you know, looking back now, I used to always blame it on him. But I was probably as toxic or more than he was, because I just had that wrong frame of mind, that wrong, you know, mindset about pleasing and doing. Yeah. And so we really, you know, it was tough. And I would know in the back of my mind I was wrong, but I didn't know how to change it. And
didn't know another way.
Right. Yeah. I, you know, it was like I just fell into this trap of, you know, continuing to do it, to fit in, to be accepted.
Right.
And when, you know, we dated for a while, and I ended up, there was one night, and for a long time I called it rape, but when I look back on it as a mature Christian, I would say that I didn't want the act, but I don't know that I said no, so I don't want to put that on this person, but as a result of it, I became...
You didn't feel like maybe you could say no.
Yeah, because I had had, you know, relations before, and so I didn't feel like I could, and I, you know, because of that, I got pregnant, and it was pretty traumatic because I was, again, falling into the trap of, if people know, they'll be so disappointed in me. Yeah. You know, my parents will disown me, and, you know, everybody will think I'm a terrible person. And and during that time, this was back, you know, late 80s, people didn't talk about life, and that it's at, you know, conception, and that, you know, this is a real human being and what it meant. And, you know, I didn't have any concept that, and especially being an only child, I didn't have nieces or nephews. I hadn't been around babies. I didn't know what life really, you know, the miracle of life. And so, you know, he was like, you've got to have an abortion. And I, you know, at first I was like, no. And then I was like, well, this is the only way. And so we made the appointment. And we went, we told our parents we were going to Little Rock for the day. We did that a lot because where we lived, it was pretty, you know, rural. And we'd go to Little Rock to go eat, go movies, that sort of thing. And it was, I walked in there, a young, naive girl. And I left a very damaged young woman. And if people tell you that it does not affect you, or they say, oh, it doesn't affect, they're wrong.
Yeah.
Because that experience is something that you can never.
Yeah.
And, you know, I there's one moment that I won't go into details about everything, but I got there, and there were protesters out front. And then, but we entered to the back, and I got in there, and the lady called me up, and she said, I had to see your driver's license, you know, and she said, well, you're not of age to do it without a parental consent. And I said, oh, I did not realize that. And she said, don't worry about it. I'll take care of it. And I often think, what if, what if? You know, but God had other plans. And, but when I left there, I was a changed person. I was damaged, and I was ashamed of myself. And I was traumatized. I mean, it is a traumatizing experience. And I mean, I was screaming. It was bad. And, you know, and I just left there like, and I couldn't tell anybody.
Yeah.
And when you hold something like that in,
yes,
it does something to you because you can't get it out. You can't tell. You can't vent or anything. Mm-hmm. And I had to keep it all to myself.
Yeah. And you can't heal when you can't let it out. Yeah.
Mm-mm.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And so after that, it wasn't long, I started passing out. And first they said I had some potassium issues and that sort of thing. And we really thought it wouldn't be anything to it. You know, it would, you know.
Yeah.
But it continued. And I would just be somewhere and out I'd go, you know. And my mom and dad took me to specialist after specialist. Yeah. And, you know, I would go and one person say, oh, you have migraines or, oh, you have heart stuff. You know, it was something different all the time. But there were never any answers.
And, not really conclusive.
And nothing ever helped. You know, no medicine, no treatments, anything. And so then I had to start dealing with that, you know, and it was rough. I mean, I can just remember, you know, so many times calling my mom from work and she having to come pick me up because I'd passed out in the classroom or at gym or whatever. And so, you know, it became my mama would say my thorn in my side. She would call that like pause, you know, she'd say, that's your thorn in your side, you know, and it became it became something that affected my life deeply.
Mm. Well, and I just want to pull out that thread of approval of man because we talk a lot about that on the podcast, and everyone can relate to that theme in their life at some point, whether they walked free of it, if they've ever seen it, recognized that in themselves or not, but everyone cares to some extent. And we can kind of tend to think, you know, we can kind of tend to put sizes on our idols. You know, oh, that's a big idol. Approval of man's smaller. It's not smaller because, I mean, just look like in your story, like that need to belong was so large that there were multiple times you said, like, I didn't really want to, but I believed I had to.
Right.
And like that drive becomes our beliefs, and like we don't even know what's at the root of it, and I just want to pull that out for people listening that think that's not really that big of a deal. It is, because it's driving so many of our decisions that we don't even realize.
That's right. And if we would just, you know, now that I'm older I can say this, but I if someone's listening that's younger, God is the only approval we need, you know, of other people. Everybody is sinful and nobody's perfect. Mm-hmm. And, you know, getting their approval is not important.
Yeah.
It's just Jesus' approval that we need.
But the beautiful thing about your story is that he works all things for the good.
He does.
And that's so powerful and wonderful. Getting back to your seizures. Or you said passing out. We haven't.
Well,
gotten there
yet. We called them seizures because.
Okay. Yeah. I wasn't sure if you had said that or not, but so when you were going to the doctors and stuff, did they say, "Oh, we think this is seizure activity"? Or
some did, and you know they would try seizure meds,
right?
And it would be horrible. I would be on the, you know, I wouldn't be able to function half the time.
Yeah.
I would, you know, it was tough, you know, because, you know, some would say that, and they would try these different medicines, and a lot of times they would just be, you know, they would drag me down.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what did that look like going into college, taking both the trauma, still the drive to want to conform and gain that approval? And I want to say, too, in a compassionate way for somebody who finds themselves in that spot, when you aren't driven by the love of the Lord, what can you be driven
exactly.
by?
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
You know, like that seems like a, I almost want to say noble pursuit to
right.
please people when you have the absence of his presence in your life, you know? And so it's very easy to fall into and be like, well, because even Christians confuse people pleasing with serving people.
Definitely.
And so I do want to just say that, but how did that need and the trauma now that you carried, and then getting into the health stuff, how did that look going into college?
Well, I was finally, you know, out of the toxic relationship by the time I got to college. And but then I started having more toxic relationships. You know, everybody I dated, you know, it just, it was always toxic. And I just, you know, I was looking for something. I was looking for the approval. I was looking for something that wasn't there, you know, and I would, you know, I would go, when I went to college, went in high school, I was like, miss everything. I was in everything. I was, you know, I got everything. I did all that. Yeah. And when I got to college, it was like, I didn't want to do that.
Yeah.
I didn't want to do sorority. I didn't want to do anything because it was like, I didn't want that pressure on me anymore because I had always felt so much pressure.
How interesting that you like innately knew like, okay, I don't want that.
I did.
Because that's going to make, that's going to spur on this thing that I felt like I had to
feed. And I think that's how I felt. I thought if I do that, it's, I'm going to be in that trap again. I'm going to have to feel you know, pleasing and have to please people and make them happy. And I don't want to do that anymore.
Right.
But, you know, I think sometimes that, you know, I didn't look for avenues. You know, I didn't go to the BCM. Mm-hmm. I didn't, you know, and every once in a while I would go to church by myself. Mm-hmm. And I would sit in the back and then nobody would say anything to me. And so then I'd think, well, I'm not wanted, you know, and I would just, and I wouldn't go back. And I knew in the back of my mind what I needed, but it was hard to pursue that, you know. And so I fell into the trap of toxic relationships. I actually, I would say I almost became an alcoholic. Drinking was a very big deal. I mean,
cope
that's
and,
because it was to help me cope.
You're right.
You know, it would soothe that for a little while.
Yeah.
And so I would, you know, go to that and do that. And so, you know, all through college, pretty much the whole 4 years, I did that. Mm-hmm. But my senior year of college, I met the love of my life.
Yeah.
Named Tim. And I knew Tim, his roommate and my roommate were engaged. And so he had come to the house. And so, because she and I had a house together and I knew him, but I didn't know him well, you know. And, but I'd always be dating someone or something. And finally, when my last, me and my boyfriend were, I said, I'm not dating anymore. I'm through with guys. I don't want to date.
Famous last words.
Exactly. You know, I'm going to be graduating soon. I'm just going to pursue, you know, career. And well, they were gone. They went to Hawaii and got married. They did, they got married that way. And so they, she had told me, she said, why don't you go out with Tim? You know, what if he asked you out? And I was like, I don't know. I'm just not into dating. And so when they were gone to Hawaii, he called and asked me out. And I turned him down a few times because I just wasn't sure. But finally, he, you know, he was persistent and I went out. And I was like, oh my gosh, guys really treat girls like this?
Yeah.
I mean, he was a gentleman, you know, open doors. He, everything was about making me happy and, you know, and I'd never had that. I'd never dated guys like that. You know, I've always dated jerks. And so, you know, he would, it was different.
Right.
And, you know, because he had Jesus.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, this is really neat. And so I can remember the next day, my mom was in town. My grandfather was in the hospital, and I went up there, and she said, well, how was your date last night? And I said, he is so nice. She goes, well, it'll never last, because she knew, you know, I never liked nice guys, you know, usually. But we started dating, and man, we knew immediately. I mean, we dated 6 months and were engaged.
Wow.
And within a year, we were married, almost a year to the date of our friends getting married.
That's so funny.
We got married and they were in our wedding.
Yes.
And but you know, to say it was easy, I would be lying.
Yeah.
Because I had so much baggage.
Yeah.
You know, I still had not told anybody about my abortion, and I mean, I told Tim, you know, before we married.
Yeah.
But I hadn't told anybody else. And so I was carrying
a lot,
so much baggage.
Well, and I think too, like one of the things I see in your story that is so common everywhere is, well, a couple things. This plays out in a couple different ways. When you feel the need of I have to constantly gain approval, what's underneath that is that you don't feel like you're worthy.
Exactly.
You don't feel like you're, and the only reason we don't feel like we have worth is because that worth has to be in Jesus Christ alone.
Exactly.
It's the only way for it to never be shaken. And so, like, when you're driven by that need to constantly have to perform or meet or whatever, I think sometimes it can play out in dating people that aren't where they need to be, because subconsciously it's like, I don't think I'm worth more. And I'm not to say those people aren't loved by the Lord, but where they are at that moment
in their life. Yeah.
And so, like, you know, we can kind of say, oh, you know, so-and-so tends to date people like that, but it's a lot of times has more to do with how they feel about themselves.
Oh, it was definitely about my self-worth.
Yeah.
Because I had none.
Right. Yeah. And also just the way that, like we talked about, you combating that perfectionism and performance, like, with, well, I'm just not going to be known. Like, I'm just not going to put myself in places that I'll be known, because I don't know if they're going to like what they see.
Or accept me.
Yeah. And so here comes Tim. He's a believer. He's a good guy, you know. And so it's kind of like, I don't know, this feels unsteady. And then you let him in. Which I think was a big thing.
It was.
You know, like.
Because at first I didn't. At first I dated a few other guys. I mean, well, I went on dates. I mean, yeah. I would say dated other guys. And I mean, he was kind of heartbroken because I, you know, went out with a cut. But yeah. I was so scared. I'm scared of what he, you know, represented.
Yes. If he rejects me, then that will confirm everything I think about myself must be true.
Right.
You know, which wouldn't have been. Mm-hmm. But we do tend to think that subconsciously. So going into your 20s and 30s.
Well, we married, we lived here because we both went to ULM and we lived here. And we knew we had to find a church, get in a church. And we joined Highland Park at that time.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of young couples in there. And we always say that church really shaped us. It really helped me in my Christian walk, because, you know, I didn't have much of a Christian walk at the time, and we loved it. We had a lot of couple friends, and you know, it really was great. But then he got a job in CrossFit, which is where he's from, and, you know, decided we wanted to move home. We bought his grandparents' house. We live on a little, we call it Toller Hill, you know, his mom and then us, and then his aunt and uncle, you know, we all live out in the country, you know, all beside each other. And we knew we wanted that for our future, for our family.
Yeah.
And so we ended up having two beautiful, healthy daughters, Allie and Anna Kate. And I mean, you know, we couldn't have asked for anything more. And we got involved. We joined First Baptist in CrossFit, and we've been there actually 28 years now in that church, and we love it. You know, we jumped in, you know, feet first. We got involved. He got involved in the Awana ministry.
Yeah.
And so I followed suit, and we did Awana. Even before, you know, we had kids, we were doing, you know, Awanas, and we got involved with youth, and we did that. And so we really, we loved our church, and we loved serving.
Yeah.
But, you know, always in the back of my mind, I was like, I'm not worthy. Mm-hmm. I'm not worthy to serve. I'm really not worthy to be here. And I mean, there were times, you know, I would sit in church on Sundays and be like, if they only knew who I was.
Yeah.
If they only knew who I was, they wouldn't want me here. You know? And I struggled with that. And I continued to have the seizures. And Tim is one of these people, he's a fix-it man.
Yeah.
And so he would look for specialists. I mean, we went all over the country, you know, going to specialists. And, you know, we found a doctor in Houston, and he really felt like it was seizures. And there were times that I would be so medicated that I could not leave my bed. And, you know, I couldn't take care of my kids. And I would be so sick and so medicated. And, you know, it was rough. I mean, and not just for me, but for him, you know. And I'm thankful that he stepped up, you know. He was a great dad, and, you know, and a great caretaker, and you know, and I'm thankful for that, because there were some pretty hard times during that season.
Absolutely. Well, and just you know, how the enemy's voice can lead you into making a decision because he's whispering, if everyone knew, they wouldn't like you, they wouldn't love you, you know. And then once you've made that decision, because you feel like it's your only choice, he whispers, well, now everybody will hate you because mm-hmm. of this. And that's just the way that
that's right.
he operates. He's the father of lies, you know, and like we can all see that in our stories. But how untrue that is, and that actually no weapon formed against you,
right,
you know, shall prevail. And so it's just so, it's cool seeing this happen in your story, but you know that
right.
truth will win.
Well, he was just always there saying those things.
Yeah.
But another way that he was really in my life mm-hmm. was fear.
Yeah.
I struggle with fear yeah. so much. Mm-hmm. I mean, just a fear that, you know, this would happen to my girls, or fear that, you know, yeah. somebody would find out. And mm-hmm. I lived in this constant fear.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, and that was the way he took that stronghold on me.
Yeah.
You know, was the fear.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's, I mean, palpable a lot mm-hmm. of days. Yeah. So they're continuing on and off. Now, how was it that you got to Mayo Clinic? When did that
come
about?
Well, you know, I was able to have, you know, I'd have, you know, times when I couldn't work or whatever, but I was yeah. able, I had a job that I got in my 30s, and I did sales I have a public relations degree, and this was a sales job. And I know this sounds funny because most people that know me think it, but I mean, I wore the hard hat, steel toe shoes. I went into meals and that sort of thing. I did industrial sales.
Yeah. And you liked it. Yeah.
I did. I loved meeting people and, you know, doing new things. And I traveled, and I loved to travel. Mm-hmm. And so I traveled a lot. And I was doing well in my career. Mm-hmm. And, but the seizures continued, and it mm-hmm. got to a point where it got really bad, and I wasn't able to travel. Yeah. I had to end up giving up my job, and that really devastated me.
Yeah.
And so Tim said, you know, let's go to Mayo Clinic. Mm-hmm. You know, we've always heard Mayo's the place, you know, to go. And and so we got the doctor in Houston to contact them, and we went to the one in Jacksonville, Florida. And I went one time just for like consults and all of that. And then they mm-hmm. scheduled me to go the next time and do all of the EEGs and all mm-hmm. of that. And so I spent a whole week there.
Yeah.
And at the end of the week in the hospital, the doctor came in and he said, Felicia, these aren't seizures. He said, have you ever had something traumatic happen in your life that has affected you?
Yeah.
And I looked at Tim because, I mean, I didn't tell people. You know, this was something I didn't share.
Yeah.
And Tim said, you need to tell him.
Yeah.
And so I told him, you know, my story. Mm-hmm. And he said, I figured. And he said, I have someone I want you to meet. Mm-hmm. And he said, I think she's going to change your life. And so he brought in a female neuropsychiatrist, was mm-hmm. what she was. And she said, Felicia, you have PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no. And I said, that's what soldiers have. I don't have that. I haven't been in the military. She said, no.
Yeah.
She said, PTSD is for anyone that has suffered a trauma.
Yeah.
And she said, I've seen 5,000 cases of it.
Yeah.
And I went, you know, and she said, I know this sounds crazy to you. Mm-hmm. She said, but what it is, she said, your body, when it goes through a trauma, she mm-hmm. said, it goes into fight or flight mode.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, your body's flighting. And she said, mm-hmm. anytime you smell, hear, feel a sense of what you went through in your trauma, mm-hmm. your body is passing out to avoid that. It's mm-hmm. it's a defense mechanism. Mm-hmm. I said, so you're saying I'm making myself do this? Mm-hmm. Because I always felt like some people thought I was crazy. And so that made me think, oh gosh, you know, she's saying I'm crazy.
Yes.
She said, oh no, ma'am.
Right.
She said, this is a subconscious thing. She said, you can't control it.
I think that is the fear, like especially if someone feels like they're having heart stuff and it's comes out to be anxiety, it's like, okay, well, I'm just, mm-hmm. am I crazy? Am I whatever? If I made this, because I mean, it's like our worst fear to be dramatic, right. you know, but it's like, no, that's just as physical.
Right. And that's what she said, because yeah. I was like, you know, oh, I'm crazy. And so
yeah.
even though she told me, no, this is subconscious, you cannot control this, mm-hmm. you know, I still had the back of my mind, I'm crazy. You know, mm-hmm. they think I'm crazy.
Yeah.
And she told me, she said, what happens when someone has a trauma is it goes, it's a mark on the front of your brain. I've never heard this before.
Yeah.
And she said, you have to work to get that to the back of your brain. Because if it's in the front of your brain, it's always going to be the forefront and it's going to do these things to you. She said, but if you do therapy and work, you can work it to the back of your brain and it's not. Wow. And I was like, wow, I never knew that. Yeah. I never knew that about our brain, you know?
Right.
And so they, she referred me. She said, I want you to start doing a therapy called EMDR. Mm-hmm. And it's electromagnetic something therapy. I can't remember all of it.
Yeah.
And basically what it is they use a form of tapping mm-hmm. and lights and motion.
I've done it before.
You have? Okay. Yeah. And mm-hmm. so to help you to work
yeah.
that trauma from the front of your brain to the back of your mm-hmm. brain. Mm-hmm. And at that time, it was not very prevalent. You know,
it's a trauma-based therapy, I think, if I understand. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And at that time, though, there weren't a lot of people around.
Yeah.
Of course, I live in a small town. So the closest person we found was a lady in Ruston.
Yeah.
And I started doing that. And I did mm-hmm. it for a year. And it did help for a while. For 3 years, I did not have a seizure. And so, I mean, we were like, man, I'm healed. This is great.
Yeah.
But I still had all that in the back of me. I wasn't healed yet.
Hadn't laid it down.
No. And so it came back. Mm-hmm. And it came back with a vengeance. I had a really bad wreck, totaled my car.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I started going to therapy again. I ended up, unfortunately, the depression and everything got so bad. Mm-hmm. I was in a mental hospital two mm-hmm. different times. I wasn't in there for long. Like, one of them was just 24 hours because it was really, I was in there with some dangerous people. And I was very scared. And my husband was like, you know, we got to get you out of here. You know, it was the therapist had done it and it was not a good experience. Mm-hmm. And then I went to another one and I was there just for a few days. And it it didn't help. You know, it wasn't what I needed because I needed Jesus. You know, I needed God focused. And this was not God focused. You know, this was more about me and, you know, my life. And so it didn't really help. So then they recommended that I do ECT, which is electro. It's basically where they shock your brain. And they go, you go in and there's people everywhere. I mean, they have beds lined up. You go in early in the morning. They line you up in these beds. They put an IV in you. They put you to sleep. They take you in this room and they shock your brain. And you do this. I was doing it like twice a week for a while. And the thing about it is, you know, that all of that anesthetic in your body and the toxins builds up. And I gained over 100 pounds with that. And I became so depressed and so dark. I mean, you know, it was just like I didn't care if I lived or died. You know, I just thought, I'm never going to get better. I'm never going to be happy. You know, I just had this cloud over me. You know, and it was like I couldn't shake it no matter what I did.
Well, and it's like, I look at your story and I look at the very beginning of like, you know, he stole your love and then he stole your peace. And then he stole your joy because you couldn't do the things you loved. And
because I couldn't drive. I couldn't work.
Now he stole your hope because you thought you were healed. And,
and I was a very independent person, you know. And it was like I felt like I just had nothing to live for, you know. And my girls, you know, growing up, and part of my anxiety and the reason I got worse when they became teenagers, I had this fear. I had this fear they were going to go through something, you know, that they were going to, you know, something was going to happen to them. And, you know, I lived in this constant fear, you know, and I couldn't get past it.
I think that's a common thing when you have had a traumatic experience and then your kids get to that age, you know, or, you know, even nieces and nephews or whatever, like it can make it, it can trigger it a little bit because you're now looking at it through the eyes of a child and you're worried for that child. Like it can.
I just didn't want them to go through what I did.
Yeah.
Yes. And it did. Yeah. It was definitely a trigger. And, you know, the psychiatrist I later got, she said, that's where you were. You know, she said, you know, that triggered you into going, you were reliving it. You were, you know, fearful of it. And, and it was a very hard time.
And I love that you talked about like EMDR being good and helpful and like the physicality of our brains. Mm-hmm. I mean, like a brain injury is just as physical as a leg injury. I mean, you know, like
we and know a lot that, of people don't realize
but we don't
that.
Treat it that way. Mm-hmm. Yes. But like an injury to your subconscious is the same. Like your brain holds that the same as a physical impact, you know. And but whenever it's not rooted in Jesus, that it won't be long lasting, just like everything else, you know, like effective but not eternal, you know. So getting us back to that moment, you've now lost your job that you loved. And now have you had your girls moved out?
Yeah. Well, Allie was married.
Yeah.
Anna Kate was about to leave for college. And she was gone a lot, you know, with her friends, doing her own thing.
Yeah.
And then Tim, he had started a new career after 23 years. He started a new career. And he was off 10 hours away working.
Yeah.
And I was all alone.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, even though I had family that loved me and that sort of thing, I still felt very isolated.
Yes. Yeah, so I was going to say the isolation and probably unable to drive like you want and go and do like you want
and,
for fear
and
of things.
Let me go back and say, you know, earlier in that year, we had talked about getting a service dog.
Yes.
And I was so excited, and my wonderful town across it raised the money. I had people that just took that on, and they were wonderful. And so, because he was $15,000.
Wow.
And they raised the money for him, and we went and met him. He was in Joplin, Missouri, and his name was Everett, and he was a black lab, and he was just the cutest thing. And we were just like, this is going to be life-changing, you know, because he could give me some independence. He would know what to do when I had one. Right. He would be able to help me and go with me places. And so that was a big excitement and, you know, and that was hope.
Yeah.
Then I got Everett.
Yeah.
And Everett had more anxiety than I did.
Yeah.
And it was horrible. I mean, we would take him, and I can remember the first time we took him on a trip, Tim and I, it was spring break, and we always took our girls somewhere for spring break when they were in, you know, growing up, because we wanted them to have that memory.
Right.
And Allie was, you know, already off and married, so we took Anna Kate and a friend, and we went, I can't even remember where we went. And, but we took Everett.
Mm-hmm.
It was a nightmare. Yeah. I mean, he was terrible riding. We went to Target one day and we were going, he pooped all the way down the aisle. And I was so embarrassed. And I was like, and then I had these people being real mean to me about it.
Yeah.
Thank goodness the Target employees weren't. And I kept saying, I'll clean it up. I'll clean, you know, I was so embarrassed. But I had several people really ugly to me. Like, that's why you don't bring a dog in a store. And, you know, even though he had a vest and it said he was a service dog, people were not very kind.
Yeah.
And I was, and so then it got to the point where he was doing things like that. And so I wouldn't. It made me isolated more because I wouldn't want to go anywhere because I was scared of what he'd do.
Right.
You know, I didn't know what he would do. And so then the depression set in again. And I finally, of course, we had a contract with a trainer. Mm-hmm. And I finally had to call him and say, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
You know, he can't do what he's trained to do. And he's giving me more anxiety. And I definitely don't need that.
Yeah.
And I hated it. But we had to send Everett back, you know. And Everett did end up having to go. One of the trainers took him as a house dog. He just wasn't.
Yes.
He just wasn't, you know, a service dog material. Yeah, and yeah. so, but the thing was for me to, I had to pick another dog, but it took 8 months to train one specifically for me.
Yeah.
And so I felt like, here I go again.
Yeah.
You know, 8 more months and I failed again. You know, I can't even get a service dog and, and, you know, and do right. And so it just put me down in that deep depression even more, you know.
Well, and your protection for your young self had moved over into, I want my husband to be able to go and do. I don't want him to be held back. I want my kids to be protected from these things and not be, not feel like I can't make it.
I didn't
want to
be a burden, you know, and I felt like, I felt like they, you know, they would have to take me places and, you know, and I just felt like everybody'd be better off without me. You know, I'm, you know, I'm in the way, you know, I'm a burden. And, you know, my dark thoughts just got really dark. Yeah. And finally, one day, I think it was a Friday, I just said to myself, tomorrow's the day. I'm going to die. And my family is no longer going to have to deal with this with me anymore. And I don't know why I chose to drink antifreeze. I mean, people ask me that all the time, and I don't know. I guess I probably wasn't brave enough to shoot myself or whatever you do. I just chose that. And so I got up that Saturday morning, and Anna Kate was gone. She was off with friends, which, you know, I wanted her to be. I wanted her to be happy and doing her thing, you know. And I started drinking it that morning. And, you know, of course, the taste is very bad. And but I was determined. You know, I was determined that this is what's going to happen. And so I started drinking it that morning. Well, one thing I did not realize was that it comes across when you have done that, it comes across as you're drunk. And I didn't know that, you know. And so by the evening time, I drank it all day, you know, like little cups of it all day. And by the evening time, Anna Kate and her friend stopped by the house to check on me. They'd been somewhere. And and I don't remember all of this. Some of it's what she's told me. But she said I was acting drunk. And she said, you know, we didn't drink. And so she was like, you know, Mom, this is, what's going on? What, you know, and she said, she couldn't figure out really. And she kept bugging me about it. She's like, have you drank something? Are you? And finally I admitted, you know, what I had done. And of course, you know, she called the ambulance immediately, called all our family. And I don't, I remember the ambulance picking me up. I don't remember anything else until I was on the airplane. They med flighted me to Little Rock because, you know, they were worried about being in renal failure. And so the next thing I remember is waking up 2 days later in a hospital and in Little Rock, and I had a dialysis port in. And they had had me on dialysis the whole time. And she said, and I woke up and she said, I said, what are you doing? Because it hurt, you know. And I was like, what are you doing? And she said, well, we're about to take your dialysis port in and out. And I said, dialysis? And she said, well, we had to get all the toxins out. And she said, but the good news is, sweetheart, you know, she was talking to me really sweet. She said, you have no permanent damage. You know, she said, you're a miracle. And I looked over at my husband. He was sitting there and he looked so sad. You know, and I was like, something changed. I mean, the cloud had lifted. And I know this sounds weird, but I looked out onto the windowsill and there was this little bird sitting out there. And I said, thank you, God, for that bird. Thank you for your creation. And I was like, healed. And I know that sounds hooky. But, I mean, it was gone. That cloud was gone. And I was like, thank you. Thank you, God. And I'd never thank God for my life. I'd always been one of these that I didn't value my life, you know. I didn't value what God had made. And at that moment, I was like, I am a miracle. And And everything changed that day. Yeah. I mean, everything changed.
Yeah.
And I can't say it was easy.
Yeah.
Because I had hurt my daughter because she found me.
Yeah.
And I'd hurt our relationship. Yeah. And I will regret that for the rest of my life. You know, I know God's forgiven me. And I know she's forgiven me. Mm-hmm. But she suffered from that. She suffered trauma from that. And I think, here I am. I never wanted my kids to have trauma. Mm-hmm. And yet I gave her that. And it took she and I a good year for our relationship because of that. And I knew that. And before that, I would have been one of these people that I'd have been like, well, if she didn't get over it, that's her problem. Mm-hmm. But now, after I'd been healed, mm-hmm. I was like, I'll do whatever it takes to heal my relationship with my daughter.
Yeah.
And I will do whatever it takes to heal a relationship with my husband because I'd hurt him and my other daughter and my mom and my, you know, everybody. And I was willing to do it. And, you know, and before, I wasn't, you know, I was too selfish and I was like, they'll have to get over it. And, and I valued that, you know, and it took a while when I first got home. You know, I won't say that I was immediately just gung-ho.
Right.
You know, everything, I'm a miracle and everything's changed. But it was a gradual, it started happening.
Yeah.
And things just started changing in my life and in my heart. Yeah. And I had been a little bit separate from the church at that time because I felt, at first, you know, people don't know how to react.
Yeah.
To people that have tried to take their life.
Right.
You know, they're scared of it or they're scared they'll say the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and so I encountered that and I kind of felt shunned a little bit by my church. And but I realized now that was a me problem. It wasn't a them problem. They didn't know.
Yeah.
They didn't know how to react or what to do. And so I was a little separate from the church for a little bit. I didn't want to go.
Mm-hmm.
I had a little bit of shame of all of it.
Yeah.
But then it just, like, one day God said, Felicia, you have to be in union with everybody and you have to, you've got to tell your story. You've got to be a part of this and you've got to heal.
Yeah.
And so I told my husband, I said, I've got to stop avoiding and I got to start going, you know, and I got to stop looking for excuses and reasons, you know, oh, you know, the preacher didn't do this or, you know, so-and-so, you know, didn't reach out. And I've got to start doing it for me.
Yeah.
And, you know, not for who's at church and, but for me.
Yeah.
And that's when I started healing. Mm-hmm. And I just, you know, and I started craving the word.
Yeah.
And I'd never done that. You know, I would, you know, in the past, I've kind of, you know, I'd do Bible studies or whatever, but I never craved the word.
Yeah.
I just, you know, I would do what it took to get by.
Yeah.
You know, to have the knowledge I needed at the time.
Right.
But all of a sudden, it was just looking at passages, and I would, you know, look up stuff, and, you know, and I was like, wow. And so after that, time kept going by, and I kept healing, you know, little by little. I got my new dog, and his name was Scuba Steve, and the trainer named him after the Adam Sandler movie Big Daddy. There was a Scuba Steve in it. And Scuba Steve, he's a golden retriever, and he changed my life. He was very calming and loving, and he knew just what to do if I was sick. And I just started getting out more and being independent, and I stopped having seizures, and life became good. And people would ask me, how are things? And I would say, life is good.
Yeah.
And because I experienced the dark life.
Yeah.
And I was in the good life, you know, because everything was not perfect.
Right.
I still had a lot of things going on, but I knew
that you were changed.
I was changed.
Yeah.
And that was all I needed.
Yeah.
And so about a year ago, the Lord laid on my heart that we needed women's ministry in our church.
Yeah.
We had it when I was a young person in the church. We had a lot of things going on. But, you know, COVID.
It did.
It took away
put
so
a
much.
Stop on a lot of
and
stuff.
It took away so much from our church, you know. And I was like, you know, women need to know they're loved. You know, we as women, we're more emotional. We're more needy in that fact. We need relationships. We need to feel accepted.
Yeah. And to hear the real things.
Exactly. Yeah. And to know, I mean, there's real people out there that have gone through real problems. Yeah. And
you're not alone.
Exactly. You're not alone. Yeah. And so God just really laid it on my heart, and I started praying about it.
Yeah.
And I went to my pastor, and I just said, I think this is what I'm supposed to do. And he said, hey, I'm all about it.
Yeah.
Go for it, you know. And so I reached out to some women at the Arkansas Baptist State Convention, and they were like, hey, we're behind you. We're going to, you know, we're going to support you, and this is what you need to do. Yeah. They helped me go to trainings.
Wow.
And I started learning about women's ministry and what I could do. And so I launched it last year in our church. And we did several socials where we just had game night and the ladies would come. And we just had such a good time and fellowship. And then I did a few service events. We did some service events. And, you know, it's a progress. It's not something that has been, it's not full force yet.
Yeah.
We're still working on it. Mm-hmm. We're still trying to make it better and do things. And we're actually going to have our first Mothers and Others brunch for Mother's Day. And what we want to do is just for all the ladies. Some ladies aren't mothers, that's okay.
Yeah.
And some ladies don't have their mothers, and that's okay. Yeah. We just want it to be for all the ladies.
Yeah.
And we're going to have the men cook brunch for the ladies and go. And, you know, and I'm still attending. In fact, I'm leaving Saturday to go to a training at the convention again. And I'm working on me, and I'm working on how I can serve others, and working on how I can improve my relationships. Mm-hmm. And I will say that not everybody knows all of my story.
Yeah.
And once I've told some people, I've lost friends, and that's been hard.
Yeah.
But I realized that God did that for a reason. And, you know, and it's not a reason maybe I understand, but it's for a season or for a reason.
It is. And sometimes, I mean, yes, there is judgment and rejection in the world, unfortunately, but sometimes it's self-protection, because when you're vulnerable and they're not ready to go there, that's intimidating
and it's
scary. Like, it's, you know, you never know, they might be living in a place where they're still trying to hide things they don't want to say, and that does not feel safe,
right?
You know, to feel like, okay, this person's offering this, I don't want them to be able to see what I want to keep hidden. And so you never know.
Right. And, you know, and I've learned, I've gone from that place where I was so worried about what other people thought.
Yeah.
And so worried if people were going to reject me because they knew my story.
Mm-hmm.
To now, I want to tell my story.
Yeah.
And if they don't accept it, I can't help that.
Yeah.
But I have to tell people what God's done in my life, because I am a miracle.
Yeah.
And, you know, my husband says all that. He says, every day I thank Jesus for your miracle, because you are, you know, you're changed. And he said, I can't explain what a difference you are, because, you know, I was very negative, you know, I was like, and, you know, I didn't, like, when people got good things, I was jealous, you know, envious, because they were good, they had good and I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I just don't feel any of that.
Yeah.
Now I'm happy for people to have good in their life. And now I just want that for everyone. And I want everyone to know my Jesus.
Yeah.
Because my Jesus is amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. And I love the thread of, like, how all the darkness tried to remove the fruit of the Spirit. But when the Spirit came full force into your story, how it's just bearing fruit left and right, you know. I mean, it just, you can't hold it back anymore.
Right.
You know, it's love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, all together, you know.
Exactly.
And even that self-control that you just talked about, you know, like, we can't even have that on by ourselves. It's not aptly named, I guess, but just so beautiful. And that, you know, you reached out at the end of season one And I don't even remember, I don't remember how, like, because you emailed me.
Right.
Yeah. And sent me your story.
Yeah.
Essentially. And it was, I think the email was called, I went back and looked this week, and it was my old email, but I went back and found it, and it said, "Your podcast is changing lives." And it was just, meant so much to me, receiving that. And one of the things you shared was gardening is one of your therapies.
Yes, just and I just started, and I don't think some people realize, you know, when I was younger, we didn't have the resources we have now.
Yeah.
But now we have so many resources
so
to
many.
Seek the Lord, you
yeah.
know. And I had always loved your father-in-law.
Yes.
And he had spoken at our church before. And yeah. I just, my husband and I, you know, sometimes listen to his message. And,
yes.
And when I heard that you had this podcast, I was like, well, gosh, you know, that's his daughter-in-law. She's got to be great, you know, because he's great. And I don't know why I had that thinking, but I just did. And I was right. And I just started listening. I get
that's
it.
Okay.
Working in my flower beds and that sort of thing
yeah.
is my therapy. You know,
yeah.
I love it. And so I was like, I'm going to start listening to that while I'm mm-hmm. working. And listening to the stories and the people mm-hmm. that you interviewed, it was so, it just gave me strength about mm-hmm. giving my story. It
yeah.
made me think, these people can do it, so can I. You
yeah.
know, I mean, they can share their story and they can be vulnerable.
Yeah.
And if they can do it, so can I. And it just, it gave me courage,
yeah.
you know, to listen to it
mm-hmm.
and to hear it. And your compassion, mm-hmm. it comes through so much on your podcast. And
thank
I love
you.
That because people like me that have all of this, we need the
mm-hmm.
compassion sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
We need somebody to say, hey,
yeah,
you know, we're
yeah.
here for you. We love you. We want to hear your story.
Yeah.
And all of that just came through to me through your podcast. And
thank
I just
you so
needed
much.
You to know that because,
yeah.
you know, I think we're so in this social media age, we're mm-hmm. so good at telling people what they're not good at.
Yeah.
But let's tell people what they are good at,
yeah,
you know.
Absolutely.
And I just felt like I needed to tell you that.
That was so kind. I can't thank you enough for that because we, you know, you don't, I mean, I think that about people and I don't follow through with it either,
mm-hmm.
you know, but like just how encouraging it is when we do, like
right.
when we obey that nudge to say like, this thing that can
right.
be small or big, you know, and I just love that so much because our vision and our why is to spur on the church. It's to help people feel not alone and to run the race
right.
set before them, you know, and throw off anything that hinders and the sin that so easily encumbers us and just to be filled with courage to live with a genuine faith. And we've talked about before, like the secondary thing of hearing someone hear a story, share a hardship that they would have believed in the past would cast judgment on their life and have someone else not leave the table.
Exactly.
But stay and love and show that compassion of the Lord helps you know when you feel like you're listening and you're sitting at the table helps you know, like, I don't think they'd leave my table either.
Right.
And that that's Jesus.
And that's how I felt, you know,
yeah.
I felt like you listen to the bad and the ugly and all of that, and you don't judge,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's important for people that have a story like mine, you know, for somebody not to judge because everybody has stuff.
Yes.
You know, and that's one thing I realized. I used to think I'm the only one that's going through this. I'm the only one that's,
yes.
you know, dealing with all this, you know,
yeah.
darkness and battles. And
mm-hmm.
But we all have stuff.
We really do. And that's like the beautiful thing to me about hearing stories. You know, sometimes, unfortunately, the podcast becomes work and I can be like, okay, I've got to prep this episode. And then when I start like going through the notes, I'm like, I am so excited about this story and sharing
yeah.
what the Lord's done because it encourages me and I know it's going to encourage someone else.
Right.
And just how like we're all going in our houses and closing our garages and not knowing that what the other person's walked through would help and encourage and spur us on,
right.
you know? And it changes my life. And so it's so just so life-giving to hear that it's helping and how your story is going to do that today.
And that's
you know.
That's my hope. You know, I pray all the time, you know, because I have kind of started speaking some, and I'd like to continue to speak. And it's not about me. I just want, if someone out there, one person I can help that says, oh my gosh, I've been there. Yeah. You know, somebody else has gone through what I have, you know, and they made it. Right. And, you know,
it wasn't the end.
Exactly. And, you know, and especially my story about the suicide, you know, side attempt. If somebody out there is contemplating that and they can say, hey, you know, I'll be okay. And, you know, I know this is funny to say, but, and I tell my daughter Anna Kate this all the time, because, you know, she's faced some battles and different things just because of her trauma from what we've been through. Mm-hmm. But I tell, my motto is, you can do hard things.
Yeah.
And I used to not think that. I used to think I was weak and I could just give up. And I've realized, hey, I've been through some really tough things and I made it. And so I say that all the time. And sometimes she'll sell me something and I'll be, Anna Kate, you can do hard things. Yeah. And you can.
Yeah.
And with
all things.
With Jesus.
Yes.
You know, and so now, I know this sounds really funny, but we've been having car issues, you know, with my car. Just different stuff has been happening. And used to, I would just let that just defeat me.
Yeah.
And now I'm like, okay, you can do hard things. You can get through this. You can get through not having a vehicle, going in the shop, you know, dealing with that. And it's even the little things.
All
in
the
life.
Other things become secondary.
Yeah. I mean, you just realize, hey, he's there in the little, in the big, and you can do it, you know, as long as you cling to that. And that's, and you know, you asked me about, you know, are there any verses?
Yes. Please share that with us.
You know, my favorite, I used to have a favorite that, you know, went along with my life in the past.
Yeah.
But my life now, my favorite is, consider it pure joy whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. Mm-hmm. And that's James 1, 2 through 4. And the reason I love that is because, you know, I'm not thankful that I went through the stuff, but I know I went through it to be where I am now.
Yeah.
And I persevered and I made it. And, you know, God gives us, you know, people are like, well, you know, if he's a good God, why does he give us trials? To make us who we are. I mean, I would not be the woman I am today without it all.
Yeah.
I mean, I was a very selfish person. I was very all about me. And now, you know, I'm different and I'm changed and God uses that. He uses it for good.
He does. I love that so much. Thank you so much for coming and sharing.
Thank you.
I know that that's not easy. Even when you know your why and you know the light, it's hard to walk back through and recount. And that old shame wants to creep up, but it was just very powerful, and it is going to change lives.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
We really appreciate you coming.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. And thank you all so much for listening in today on The Salt Works. We know that you have some things to journal about, some things to write down, some things that may have been life-changing in today's episode. And we're just so excited to hear that and be praying for you. And we'll see you next week on The Salt Works.
This is my story. This is your story.